This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Heart Greens. Helping to support healthy blood pressure and circulation just became hassle-free. Introducing Heart Greens, the functional food that you drink, using the same dark leafy greens recommended by both the DASH and Mediterranean diets. Get a free canister of Heart Greens with your first order and a 100% money-back guarantee. Heart Greens even guarantees you'll love the taste. Call 800-951-8940. That's 800-951-8940. Or visit IntelligentGreens.com. That's IntelligentGreens.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's theme is anti-aging. We're going to talk to the author of a brand new book. It really covers a lot of ground on the anti-aging front. It's called Cracking the Aging Code. Our guest is the author, Josh Middledorf. And the subtitle of the book, Cracking the Aging Code, is The New Science of Growing Old and What It Means for Staying Young. And there's some really original theoretical discussion in this book, but also some practical news that you can use. So we hope to bring both of those to you. Josh Middledorf has a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania. He runs an excellent website entitled agingadvice.org, and he writes a weekly column for scienceblog.com, and he's author of more than 24 peer-reviewed articles on the biology of aging. He's had visiting research and teaching positions at various institutions, including MIT, Harvard, and Berkeley. And so without further ado, here's Dr. Middledorf. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me, Ron.
It's my pleasure. You see aging in a different way. You actually kind of lay out a different manifesto about the process of aging. So why don't you share that with us?
Well, this is what brought me into the field, was realizing that the evolutionary biologists have it wrong. Lay people are more likely to have it right. The most common conception of what aging is the body just wears out. There's oxidative damage. There's the wear and tear on our joints. There's the damage that molecules suffer at the level of DNA copying. And that all combines to do us in the end. And what I discovered is that this isn't inevitable. It's a programmed process. The body is not trying to live forever. The body is trying to kill itself after a while. And this has repercussions in all kinds of directions, but that one idea has become the center of my research the last 20 years.
And you refer to this as the demographic theory of aging, or you look at aging in its evolutionary role, and you even have referred to something called the death program. Could you share what you mean by that?
There's so much in what you're asking, right? We could go in different directions. The death program is simply that evolution has programmed into our genes, not through genes that are specifically designed to age us, but through epigenetics, which genes are expressed when, a self-destruction process. So after age 40 or 50, a lot of the processes that used to work to protect us are now working to do us in. Examples of that are inflammation. Probably the best example. Inflammation is essential. We need it to protect us against invading microbes. But inflammation turns chronic, and it turns against the self later in life. Inflammation is the chief risk factor for heart disease, Alzheimer's disease, and cancer, the three big killers of old age. And this is not a malfunction of the inflammation system, this is taking a system that was at one point in our life designed to protect us and turning it to a different use.
And so it tends to, what is helpful for getting us to reproductive age so that we have offspring, this is an evolutionary advantage, may turn to a disadvantage. But do you speculate that that death programming is kind of nature's cleanup crew, you know, to sort of keep the demographic overload to a minimum?
I'd like to separate. First, you have overwhelming empirical evidence that the body really is trying to kill itself. And that's undeniable. Speculating on that, well, why would that be? And what's the evolutionary purpose of it? I have a theory of aging that I'm very fond of course. I think it's right. But the evidence for that is not nearly so strong as the evidence for the empirical fact that there is an aging program. So my theory, I call it the demographic theory of aging. And the idea is that aging exists so that we don't all die at once. Suppose there were no such thing as aging. What would we die of? Well, we don't die overwhelmingly of starvation. We would just eat and eat until there's no food left. And when there's no food left for me, there's probably no food for you either. And the whole population undergoes a famine. So everybody would be dying at once in a famine. An epidemic is the second most common cause of mass deaths. A virus comes along that everybody can handle, that's fine, and nobody dies. And then a virus comes along that nobody can handle, and everyone dies at once. So you'd have these population swings wildly up and down. It would be bad for ecosystem stability. It would be a risk of extinction, which I believe is really the driving force. If Darwinian evolution is about anything else, anything at all, it's about avoiding extinction and leveling out the death rate in good times and in bad times is what aging does. And the purpose, the evolutionary purpose, is to avoid extinctions.
Well, recently, there was an article that got a lot of attention in the media, which speculated that the ultimate limit for human longevity is about 140 years. And beyond that, no way, no how. There's no conceivable technology that can surmount that limitation. Do you agree with that proposition? Presumably, you saw that article and, you know, it made a big splash.
I did see it. And you know what it reminded me? It was 1904 when Scientific American, of all things, published an article proving the impossibility of heavier-than-air flight, that it just would never be. And of course, this was 2 years after the Wright brothers' flight, which whoever wrote this didn't know about. You know, it's very easy to speculate that, the science that we have is the only science that will ever exist, and nothing will ever be discovered in the future that can possibly extend human life beyond 140 years. And there's just no reason to believe that there are fixed limits like that on what science can discover.
Well, given that there is a sort of a death program, that there's an inevitability to a process by which we move steadily towards, you know, call it entropy, call it death, call it degenerative changes, is it all futile? I mean, what are the implications for self-care? And you certainly are someone who advocates many different self-care measures.
On the individual level, this idea is really very optimistic. And suppose you believe that the body was just wearing out and, evolution has tried every trick in the book for a billion years to make us live as long as possible and are 70. That's the best that evolution has been able to come up with. What are the chances that we in our laboratories would be able to do better than what evolution has been trying so hard to do for a billion years? But if you think that aging is programmed into our genes, if you think evolution really isn't trying to make us live a long time, but has put these death mechanisms in, then really it's much more optimistic for anti-aging mechanisms. What it means is that our task in anti-aging biology is to block those mechanisms. And we know how to do that. Designer drugs are created all the time that take a specific hormone and block the action of that hormone, maybe jam a receptor so that the receptor can't receive that hormone anymore, interfere with any number of biochemical paths. This is the way MAOI inhibitors work, and this is the way COX-2 inhibitors work, and serotonin reuptake inhibitors. All kinds of pharmaceutical discoveries are based on this idea. You just block an existing mechanism, and it works really well. So the optimistic message is that this should be applicable to aging as well. We should be able to block aging if aging is a genetic program.
I mean, maybe it's the analogy would be to a safecracker. You know, just because there's redundant systems that protect a vault doesn't mean that through skilled manipulation they can't be surmounted, you know, one by one, eventually yielding the treasure inside.
Yes, I like that a lot. I think there are multiple redundant mechanisms of aging. We know that much. And we're not going to solve the problem of aging with one pill. But if we're lucky, it might be a manageable number, say less than a dozen different interventions will block all of the major modes of aging.
Well, before we get into what you're an advocate for, what are some of the trends in anti-aging that you're not that happy with? Are you a fan of spare parts medicine? Are you a fan of stem cells? What are some of the areas that maybe make you feel queasy about this?
Okay, all right. So I'll say two things. That I think are the wrong directions. One is antioxidants. Antioxidants come from this wear and tear theory of aging, that oxidative damage is the main cause of aging. The theory has been discredited for a long time. And what's more, every time we've tried antioxidants in animals and in people, antioxidants don't work to extend lifespan. And yet, how many times a day do you see advertisements for this and that antioxidant? Mm-hmm. This is what's going to make you healthier. So skip the antioxidants. There's one prominent exception. Glutathione is the body's one of the body's own antioxidants, and I do believe that glutathione has anti-aging properties. But the whole antioxidant craze. It's market-driven. It's not research-driven at this point.
This would be going back to the era of Denham Harmon, you know, the antioxidant or free radical theory
exactly.
of aging, that
yes.
whole thing,
yep.
Which is so 1970s, I guess, 1960s.
Yeah, I think 62 was his first paper on the free radical theory of aging.
Mm-hmm.
And so the second thing that I would say is kind of a dead end is this engineering approach that we look at what's wrong with the body and we engineer a better solution. And if people can do that, more power to them. But gee, there's a better way. The body knows how to be young. The body knows how to be old. Each of us who is old has a body that was once young and knows how to be young again. If we just change the signaling environment, then the body will do it for us. And we don't have to engineer these solutions that just go, bioengineering is tough. And I do believe there's an easier way by changing the signaling environment of the body. We don't have to go, wait till things go wrong and then engineer a substitute.
So what essentially you're talking about is spare parts medicine, you know, where you literally we take pluripotent stem cells, create scaffoldings, and we generate new hearts, new kidneys, new lungs, new limbs, perhaps even eventually new brains for people. You see that as potentially costly, futile endeavor.
You lump together a lot of different technologies here. Stem cells are enormously promising, and I think they will be part of the solution to aging that's coming in the next few years. The scaffolding and rebuilding organs, there will be people whose organs are destroyed in an accident or alcoholics destroy their livers, and that technology will be useful. It's not the most efficient way to attack the general problem of aging, but I have nothing but admiration for the people who are working on creating artificial organs with stem cells and scaffolding.
But I guess the distinction is that you don't think that they get really to the basic process of aging. They may offer us the opportunity for repair, but perhaps they're not the solution for truly extending longevity in a meaningful way.
Well, I think we can do better. I think the body can be prompted to do that work itself. And the most promising paths, I think, are to find those signal molecules that tell the body that it's old and remove them, to find the signal molecules that tell the body it's young and add them back, rebalance the hormones that are the body's primary aging clock.
And one popular nostrum for anti-aging purposes is growth hormone. Are you a believer in growth hormone? Do you think it has rejuvenative properties, or is it oversold?
I don't know. I've seen evidence in both directions. On the best thing that I can say about growth hormone is there's a clinical trial going on right now for regrowing the thymus using growth hormones. And the thymus is where our T cells are trained. These are white blood cells that recognize invaders and attack the invaders and don't attack the self. So every T cell is born naive, and it travels through the thymus where it learns, this is self. You take care of any molecule, of any cell that's got these markers. And this is invader, and you attack it and destroy it. The thymus is responsible for that, for drawing that distinction and for training all of our white blood cells to, on the one hand, not make the mistake of attacking the self, and on the other, be vigorous about attacking invaders, including cells that turn cancerous. Well, the thymus shrinks. It's starting in puberty, and we have very little thymus left by the time we're 80 or 90 years old. It's thought that that has a lot to do with the reason that autoimmune diseases are such a big part of aging. Has a lot to do with why 90-year-olds get pneumonia and die of it when a 30-year-old would never get pneumonia in the first place, let alone to die of it. So regrowing the thymus, I think, is a great project. I think growth hormone in a temporary treatment is proving to be quite viable way to regrow the thymus. And so there's the best thing I can say about growth hormone. The worst thing I can say about growth hormone is that animals that are genetically engineered to have extra growth hormone live shortened lifespans.
Shorter lives, yeah.
Shorter lifespans, right. And animals that, for some reason, either by genetic engineering or by an accident of a mutation, have less growth hormone or less effective growth hormone they do have extended lifespans. So this is just good reason to be suspicious that growth hormone might make you feel good in the present, but it might not be good for you in the long run.
What are some other ways to support thymic function or support the immune function towards the goal of extending life?
From the esoteric, there are huge proteins which are expensive and unavailable. FOXN1 is very promising, but how do you get it into the body, and how do you get it to the thymus, and how do you pay for it? To the mundane, vitamin D is cheap. It's easy to take. There are no side effects. Most people living in temperate climates who don't get sun all day long are deficient in vitamin D. Not according to the standard of the FDA, which says get 600 international units every day. But according to the blood count, there's a mismatch between the blood counts, which tend to be low, and the recommended daily allowance, which I think it's just something that the FDA has been slow to correct. There's good evidence that getting your blood count, if it's down in the 20s or 30s, get it up to the 90s. There are all kinds of benefits from that, including lower cancer rates and better immune function. So there's the easiest thing you can do to boost your immune function.
Great. Okay, well, we set the stage for a discussion of some promising avenues for cracking the aging code. That's the title of a book by today's guest, Dr. Josh Middledorf. And Josh, we'll return with you. Our listeners know we divide these podcasts into two parts. We'll turn with you and talk about some more strategies for pushing back against the inexorable process of aging. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.